This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn Mark, Roshan Kanison and Noel Lim. 7:07 a.m. Friday, the 16th of April. And in about 15 minutes, we're going to be speaking about what it means now that the federal government has returned control of two islands to Sabah. But before that, let's take a look at the markets.
In the US, the Dow closed up 0.9%, closing above 34,000 for the first time after strong earnings and economic data sent stocks climbing. S&P 500 closed up 1.1%, Nasdaq closed up 1.3%.
In fact, if we take a look at European markets, they were also in the green. The FTSE 100 were closed up 0.6%, the DAX index Germany out of Germany closed up 0.3%, and the France's CAC 40 index closed up 0.4% as well. Very nice green day out of Europe. If you take a look at some commodities, gold marginally in the red, $1,763 an ounce, easing a bit on the year-to-date losses. It's now only 7.1% in the red year-to-date. Brent crude, 29% up year-to-date, up 0.5% this morning, now just under $67, with $67 a barrel. We're seeing a bit of strengthening in there over the week. And of course, I must always take a look at Bitcoin. It is 118% up year to date. Right now, $63,400 a Bitcoin.
And if we look at kind of some of the Asian markets as well, the Shanghai Composite was down 0.5%, and the Hang Seng was down 0.4%. But the rest of the Asian region, the major markets that we look at, they were in the green. The Nikkei was up 0.1%, Singapore up 0.2%, and the FBM KLCI up 0.6%. So for more insight into global markets, we have on the line with us this morning Carlos Casanova, Senior Economist at UBP. Carlos, thanks for joining us today. So the Trump administration listed China and other countries as currency manipulators in the past. What might be the motivation of not including China on the list this time around?
Good morning. Well, first of all, the label of currency manipulator for China by the Trump administration was not accurate, to be very honest with you, because in this case, the central bank does intervene in the international foreign exchange market, but it does so to support the value of its currency, not to undermine the value of its currency. So in that sense, I think sort of the Econ 101 of the previous stance on China's currency was not entirely accurate on Trump's administration's behalf. Second, of course, is Biden is going to approach the containment issue from a slightly different angle, and he is likely going to look to engage partners and work on sort of the technology and the access to financing side. So the political component of it and the sort of threat of manipulation, etc., that takes a secondary role to this more coordinated approach that we've seen in the past weeks.
So Carlos, unless I'm mistaken, I'm pretty sure Malaysia's on the list as well right now. What makes a country a currency manipulator then? Because there are obviously metrics that the US Treasury pays attention to. What are those?
First of all, is a sustained current account surplus with the United States. And second, of course, is your currency has to be a managed float, and there has to be evidence that, there are signs that it could be stronger than it currently is. So that is not the case for the yuan at the moment, but there are other currencies, including the euro, that could potentially, be labeled as currency manipulators because that current account surplus, especially in the case of Germany, is very persistent.
Well, is that something we really need to worry about, considering I think Malaysia and Singapore are on that list?
No, I think something to consider about this year is the fact that despite a very remarkable U.S. yield curve steepening, the U.S. dollar remains rather modest. So it doesn't translate into the sort of magnitude of outflows from the region that we've seen in previous instances of tapering in the past. I think that is more of a risk to the region than the potential threat of being labeled a currency manipulator, which Biden is going to move or should be moving sort of away from.
So if we take a look at, the Chinese yuan, which has strengthened due to a recent pullback in the US dollar, is this something that you foresee the PBOC will be comfortable with?
In the case of the yuan, that strength was actually beneficial for the restructuring of the onshore debt. And we have seen that making headlines in the recent weeks. We do expect that the yuan will remain on a gradual appreciation path against the US dollar. However, in the short term, due to this building narrative surrounding US recovery and the very rapid pace of US yield curve steepening, remember the 10-year is at approximately 1.6% right now, which is below pre-COVID-19 levels of 1.8%. Everything else, every other asset class is already above pre-COVID-19 level. So we do see that there's going to be a little bit of rally left in that trade before we reach an equilibrium. So in that sense, there are downside depreciatory risks on the yuan. It could be problematic. So the depreciation actually could be problematic in the sense of what we are seeing surrounding Huarong and a lot of the fresh concerns about onshore debt. But in the long term, it's not an issue because the yuan will remain on that gradual appreciatory path against the dollar. And the reason for that is this idiosyncratic component in the U.S. with that widening current account deficit in the U.S. Of course, better recovery in that market means American consumers will consume more, which means bigger imports, which means a bigger trade deficit. And also all of the debt that was rolled out to stimulate the economy post-COVID, that will have to be serviced as well at some point. So long-term US dollar weakness should continue to prop up the yuan. Not an issue, but in the short term, depreciation, on the other hand, could become an issue.
Well, on that note, and about your earlier comments about Biden's shift away from that list, how do you foresee his policies would be different from Trump?
So Biden is already adopting a more multilateral approach. I would say that is the main difference that we are observing between Trump and Biden. He's not only reaching out to the European Union having spearheaded a coordinated initiative, very high-profile initiative to impose sanctions on Chinese officials on alleged human rights violations in Xinjiang. That is a very clear departure from Trump's administration. But he has also started to reach out more aggressively to regional peers in Asia, forming a coalition with Australia, India, and also Japan to start to contain China within the region as well. That is a very clear departure from Trump's America First agenda. And it is a more real threat for China. I think it's something that they have priced into their strategic plan with this domestic pivot that they plan to achieve as part of the 14th five-year plan. But nonetheless, it's a clear departure and a lingering risk for China.
Carlos, Singapore's flash Q1 GDP figures surprised market consensus on the upside. What sectors were driving growth for them?
Singapore did surprise. So we saw that GDP entering expansionary territory in Q1, 0.2% year-on-year. On a sequential basis, so against the previous quarter, that growth was even more remarkable, around 3%, if I don't remember incorrectly. Now, of course, in the case of Singapore so far, or for the last few quarters, the recovery on a quarter-on-quarter basis has been led by the manufacturing sector, lots of exports, in particular, supply chains that are very Asia-heavy, like the electronic supply chain, have been doing very well during COVID-19 times. So that has been helping to prop activity, and it was no different in Q1. In fact, the fact that there's a global shortage of semiconductors actually exerted upside pressure on the price of some of these chips, which Singapore exports, and that might have also helped to prop up the manufacturing sector and the export front in Q1. What was surprising, and in my opinion is what probably did tilt the balance in favor of growth in year-on-year terms in Q1, was the fact that domestic consumption was much more solid than expected. And actually, retail sales in Singapore did perform better, entered positive territory as well. That is a sign that despite the situation on the employment front remains fragile, so it's not by no means recovery in all sectors, but there is pent-up demand. And so during the sort of festive seasons in the first quarter of the year, Singaporean consumers actually went out and did spend more money. So that is something to watch out for Q2, which is where we're going to see that real pickup in growth.
Thanks so much for speaking with us this morning, Carlos. That was Carlos Casanova, senior economist at UBP, giving us some insight into what's happening in several of our typical global markets. But we are also taking a look at some earnings this morning because Wall Street giants continue to smash expectations.
Smash they did. Bank of America revenue from sales and trading jumped more than expected, while equity underwriting fees more than tripled. Still, shares fell 3% as investors worried about tepid loan growth after higher costs. Bank of America is, of course, more of a retail bank than it is an investment bank. The firm also announced a $25 billion share buyback plan. Citibank, they reaped the most revenue from stock trading in the first quarter since 2009, while fees from underwriting shares quadrupled, helped by the firm's dominance in SPACs. The company will exit retail banking in 13 markets across Asia and Europe, and that does include Malaysia as well. And to round this off, Morgan Stanley closes out big bank earnings before the bell later today. Analysts are expecting strong top-line results driven by robust quarter for equities trading.
And up next, we're going to be speaking about some of the latest developments in MA63 talks between Putrajaya, Sabah and Sarawak. So be sure to stay tuned to BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.